Hello, I'd like to welcome everyone today. If I could have your attention, my name is Lisa Falsko, CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council. Such a pleasure to see so many people on this incredibly icy day. I can't believe so many people really like the food here at the Hilton. Thank you. So we are really excited about our season starting, and we have a lot of new things up on our lineup. If you aren't a member, please consider joining the Alaska World Affairs Council and checking out our website. We have a world music festival that we're starting for the first time this year with Alaska Public Media and the Concert Association. We also have a pub trivia night for any of you trivia buffs who are over 21 at the Taproot in January. And for any students who are here, we have our annual World Quest competition. And there are some cards on tables, more information on our website if anybody wants to sponsor it. Also, students, the winning team of four, you compete for this competition in teams of four, and the winning team gets a free trip to Washington, D.C. to compete in the national competition. So check that out. You're tested on all sorts of things like geography, current affairs, cybersecurity. It's a fun competition. If you could please take a moment at this time to turn off your cell phones. Today's program is being recorded for the radio. It will be available if you want to listen to it or tell a friend. You can either come to our website and get a link to this program, or you can go directly to Alaska Public Media and search for it under AWAC Presents, and you can hear it again. We do have, like I mentioned, several high school students. If you are a student, would you mind standing and being recognized? We are so excited that you made it here today. Aha. Fabulous. Thank you so much for coming, and we want to thank BP for sponsoring our student program. Please consider coming again and asking a question at the end. We'll record that, and you'll be famous. And Kari, if you can hear me, if you want to bring up the raffle ticket, we do have a raffle today for a bread basket. Oh, it's coming on its way. I think the odds are pretty good for whoever put their name in for that. Talking about partners, I'd like to thank the Alaska Economic Development Corporation. Bill Popp was supposed to be here. He'll be coming a little bit later. He's stuck in the ice somewhere, but he will have a couple words to say at the end. So at this time, we'll go right to the breadbasket, and I'll ask our illustrious speaker to pick the winning number. It is 903668. Aha, fantastic. You can bring that back, share it with your friends. You're going to be the most popular person, and it's at the front desk. Or right back there. And we'll just get right on with our program. I'd like to introduce our head table. To my far left is Chuck Colson, the chairman of our board. He's the person who makes my job wonderful every day, and I'm so excited that he is leading our organization and helping with all these great new ideas. And to his right, we have Mr. Timothy Thomas, who brought this program to our attention and is helping with our Global Health Series. And he's going to come to the podium and introduce our speaker, Mr. Tim Thomas.
Thank you, and welcome, everybody. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Jay Butler today. I've known Jay since I think the late 1990s when I was an epidemic intelligence service officer with the CDC working here in Anchorage. And Dr. Butler had recently arrived at the Arctic Investigations Program. I left for Kenya to work there for about 8 years and came back. And soon after I came back, Jay asked me if I wanted to work at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, where he is now head of the Division of Community Health Services. And I was very excited about that opportunity. So I'm about to introduce my boss. I saw Dr. Butler speak at a conference at the Alaska Public Health Association conference a couple years ago, and he gave a talk on issues around social justice. And I was very impressed by that talk, and I asked him to actually sort of maybe give that talk or a semblance of it today He says he's retained one slide from that presentation. So I don't know. I don't know exactly what's coming up. But Dr. Butler is a very bright gentleman. He's board certified in multiple areas of medicine, infectious disease, pediatrics, and internal medicine. He worked for Centers for Disease Control for a long time. He led investigations into Hantavirus, and was also the lead for CDC on the most recent flu pandemic. He has worked as the Alaska State Epidemiologist and also as the Alaska Chief Medical Officer. So without further ado, I'd like to have you welcome Dr. Butler to the podium. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. I've already done your annual performance evaluation, so you really didn't need to be that nice. Thank you. Well, I'm very impressed with the level of interest in health in the room, and thank you for coming down. I don't know who ran the Zamboni up and down 3rd Avenue, but I'm glad you were able to drive here, get across the street from the parking lot, and make it safely into the building. I know you have a high level of interest. I know it's after lunch. I may run the risk of putting a few of you to sleep. So let me start with a spoiler alert. I've posed a question about health. Is it a personal, public, or social issue? Here's the spoiler alert. If there's any hope of improving global health status and resolving health disparities, the answer to the question is yes, all of the above. I hope to make the case for that answer in the time that we have remaining, and also touch on some of the global trends that I think will be influencing health in the coming decades. But we should start with a more basic question. What is health, and how do we measure it? If you do a Google image search of the word healthy, you'll get lots of pictures of skinny people doing yoga on the beach at dawn. But health is more than that. So I think the definition that I'm going to want to use, and the one that I like best, is one that stood for more than 60 years in the preamble to the Constitution of the World Health Organization, which is that health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. Well, that sounds really good, but how do we measure the absence of disease or infirmity? I used to have a bathroom scale that was made by the Healthometer company, and I'm afraid to say there is no healthometer for global health. So we have to revert back to some of those more objective measures of disease and disability. Now, epidemiologists can spend weeks debating the definitions of cases of disease or what defines disability, but ultimately the most obvious and objective measure of the absence of health is death. As the 19th century English statistician and public health pioneer William Farr observed, death is a fact, all else is inference. So one of the most common ways we measure health is then, ironically, mortality. Specific measures include life expectancy, how long do we live, ranking of the causes of death, and also measures of premature death. One that you may have heard of is years of potential life lost, or the YPLL. A couple of assumptions go into the calculation of YPLL. First is that we all have an expected life ahead of us. Second is that life is a sexually transmitted condition that is 100% fatal. We are all going to die sooner or later. So I'm going to use myself as an example. I'm 55 years old, and let's say for the sake of discussion that my 1958 birth cohort has a life expectancy of 75 years. I leave today distracted by the rambling and unfocused presentation. I step out on slippery 3rd Avenue. I'm struck by a truck going too fast, and I'm killed. I've just contributed 20 years to the pool of years of potential life lost. I'm so glad my wife looks worried by that. But A better measure is what's the quality of life until that final moment of life. Now, we might all like to think that we're going to live to 90 and be shot by a jealous lover, but very few of us come to the end of life and backstroke across that old River Jordan in a state of perfect health. So another measure is healthy life expectancy measured by the disability-adjusted life years, or so-called DALYs, which may be measured in terms of what's gained by a health intervention or what's lost due to a disease. At its simplest, and I'm not a statistician, I'm looking at my statistician friends out there, and some of them are cringing, is it's the years of potential life lost plus years of disability. So let's return to my earlier example. If Dr. Stewart sees me lying in the street and quickly addresses my collapsed lung, saves my life, but I still have an injury that's going to limit my mobility for the next 5 years, I will have contributed 5 years to the disability years of life lost. And that's assuming that I'm more careful crossing the street in the future and do indeed make it to age 75. That's not a good sign. There we go. Thank you. We all need to back up our hard drives, but not in the middle of a presentation. So I want to spend a few minutes using these measures to take a quick pulse on global health status. So if we start with life expectancy, we see some obvious disparities among the nations of the world. Some nations actually have life expectancies now of longer than 80 years, such as Japan, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand, most of Europe and Scandinavia, and Canada. In most all of the Americas, life expectancy is more than 70 years. But there are still many parts of the world where life expectancy is less than 60, and in some countries, such as the Democratic Republic of Congo and the Central African Republic, life expectancy is still less than 50 years. We also have to recognize that there are disparities within nations, and I'm going to use an American example. An Asian woman living in the northeastern United States today has a life expectancy approaching 90 years. However, an African American man living in the inner city has a life expectancy barely 60 years. There are major differences in the cause of death when we look at nations stratified by socioeconomic status. In the 17 lowest income countries in the world, the leading causes of death are oftentimes infectious diseases, pneumonia, HIV/AIDS, and diarrhea. It's not down till we get to the fourth and fifth leading causes of death that we find things like stroke and ischemic heart disease, which are the leading causes of death in the wealthier countries of the world. In the high-income nations, as we go down the list, we find the predominant causes of death are the diseases that are oftentimes associated with age and with a longer period of exposure to tobacco, such as lung cancer, Alzheimer's disease, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and colorectal cancer. If we use our measure of disability-adjusted life years lost in the world, we'll use 2010 as the latest data, we see that heart disease and stroke are number 1 and 3, but some of those diseases that primarily affect young people in poor countries are also high on the list, such as pneumonia, diarrhea, HIV/AIDS, and malaria. And you also see that my donation of 5 years of dollies for road traffic injuries is also in the global top 10. So how do we improve global health and reduce health disparities? I think in terms of four realms of influence on health, and this is where the title of the presentation came from. The first two are personal. Access of the individual to quality health care is where the provider uses clinical training and experience to treat the individual patient. All of us have probably been to a provider. No, I don't need to say anything more. This is what we often call health care, but is in fact disease care. And while many providers today have more of an emphasis on prevention, I have to say as a provider, most all of my training was on rescuing people from states of disease and injury. The second personal realm is, I'm going to use the term personal responsibility. This is when the individual utilizes available knowledge and alters behavior to improve and maintain health. I'm a little hesitant to use this term because I think, unfortunately, it's been a banner that's been used in many countries to argue against social programs or government expenditures on health. The public realm is public health, the discipline that addresses issues that influence the health status of the entire population or groups of people who are at higher risk of poor health outcomes. Public health addresses issues that affect the health of all and may range from immunization programs to clean air ordinances. The final realm I'll elaborate on in a few minutes is the social determinants of health. And this includes a broader range of factors that both directly and indirectly influence health. So how do each of the realms influence health? A much-cited analysis was conducted by Michael McGinnis and colleagues a little over a decade ago. It estimated that only about 10% of health is determined by access to medical care. 15% is directly influenced by the social realm. A whopping 40% is determined by behavioral choices of the individual. However tempting it may be to file the 40% under personal responsibility, I want to spend some time talking about how behavior is also driven by the public realm and indirectly by the social realm. The American Public Health Association has described 10 essential functions of public health, but given time, I really want to highlight only the first four. Those include monitoring health status to identify community health problems, diagnosing and investigating health problems and health hazards in the community, to inform, educate, and empower people about health issues, and to mobilize community partnerships to identify and solve health problems. So starting with public health, the ultimate measure of success in the public realm, or the holy grail of public health, is disease elimination and eradication. Elimination is when there is zero disease in a defined geographic area, although control measures may still be needed to prevent reestablishment of the disease or further spread in the case of an infection. Eradication is when there's zero disease globally. Control measures are no longer needed. The first attempt at disease eradication was launched in the 1960s to rid the world of smallpox. It was an ambitious effort, given that at the time, there were large areas of the world where the disease was still rampant and easily transmitted. But mobilization of international resources and partnerships was huge, and the strategy was brilliantly simple. One of surveillance and containment. Search for the cases of infection, identify the people who had been in contact with those infectious persons and vaccinate them, and then identify the contacts of the contacts so that you've created a realm of immunity circling out to those 2 degrees of separation. And this strategy worked. The last case of naturally occurring smallpox was in Somalia in 1977. Smallpox became the first disease eradicated through work in the public realm. WHO declared in 1980, smallpox is dead. Smallpox vaccine is no longer routinely needed. My kids and my grandkids don't have smallpox vaccination scars. It's now a sign of being of a certain age or having been in the uniformed services. And some of us actually have scars on both sides because of that. I know the trivia night is coming up. I'm looking over here at the honor roll table from service and the honor roll table in the back. If one of the questions comes up, what was the second disease successfully eradicated? Let me warn you, it's a trick question because they didn't specify human disease. But there is a second disease. Does anybody know what it is? It's rinderpest, sometimes known as cattle plague, disease which has had huge agricultural impact and then in turn human impact because of the dependence of humans on cattle. And this has now been eradicated from the world 3 years ago. The next human disease that's approaching eradication is guinea worm or dracunculiasis. And at this point, We should all thank Lisa for honoring my request that linguine be kept off the menu today. Guinea worm is a painful and debilitating disease that's been common for millennia. Some have even speculated that this was the fiery serpent referred to in the book of Numbers. When guinea worm was first targeted for eradication in 1986, more than 3.5 million cases occurred on the African continent alone. In 2012, that number was down to 542, and transmission was restricted to just four of the poorest countries: Ethiopia, South Sudan, Chad, and Mali. The most amazing thing is that this eradication is primarily through dissemination of information rather than immunization or any kind of high-tech intervention. Taking advantage of our scientific intel on the life cycle of the worm. When the adult guinea worm is ready to raise a family, it migrates to the foot or the lower leg and creates a sore, and this is quite painful. And the tendency is to want to soak that sore in water. When the mama guinea worm senses water, she will actually come through that sore and dispel her larvae into the water. The larvae then infect copepods, which are small crustaceans, also called water fleas, that are in the water. They complete two more stages of their life cycle within the water fleas. If a human ingests that water, they will also ingest the water fleas. In the stomach, the water fleas are digested, the larvae are released, they can then penetrate the walls of the stomach and the intestine, and then about a year later, the female adult worm migrates south down to the lower extremity and the foot, and the vicious cycle starts all over again, putting the host at risk of not only disability due to pain and possible permanent disfigurement, but also risk of life-threatening bacterial infection. Obviously, modern sanitation could take care of this problem, but in the short term, this isn't feasible in the remote areas where even boiling water can be a challenge. This is where information and low-tech tools in the public realm can create personal behavior changes. There's graphic novels about the life cycle of the guinea worm that help kids understand why it's important that they keep their feet out of water sources. The water fleas are large enough actually to be filtered out of drinking water. For areas where water is still acquired for drinking primarily directly from surface pools, straws can be used with filters made from cloth scraps. Education is oftentimes done by village leaders so that this new technology, very low-tech technology, it can be passed on and thus inspiring personal responsibility for the young. But even the best effort of healthcare workers and public health professionals can be frustrated without addressing the social realm. And I'm talking about the social determinants of health, which can be kind of a vague term, but I think there's, again, I'm going to turn to the WHO for a good definition, which defines social determinants of health as the conditions in which people were born, grow, live, work, and age. These circumstances are shaped by the distribution of money, power, and resources at global, national, and local levels. The social determinants of health are mostly responsible for health inequities in the world. Some examples of social determinants, and this is not by any means an exhaustive list, include employment, availability of good work and working conditions, the levels of poverty in a community and socioeconomic factors, the level of education and literacy, the availability of safe transportation and housing, social factors such as discrimination, which could be on the basis of race, gender, or class, and political factors such as unrest or wars. Watching that water made me thirsty. Some of you may have contributed to the Healthy Alaskans 2020 effort and are familiar with the story of Jason to highlight the social determinants. And it goes like this. Why is Jason in the hospital? He has an infection in his leg. Why does he have an infection? He cut his leg and it got infected. Why does he have a cut on his leg? He was playing in the junkyard next to his apartment building and fell on a sharp, jagged piece of steel. Why was he playing in a junkyard? A lot of kids play there. There's no playground in his neighborhood. Why does he live in that neighborhood? His parents can't afford a nicer place to live. Why can't his parents afford a nicer place to live? His dad is unemployed and his mom is sick. And why is his dad unemployed? He doesn't have much education, and where he used to work is closed. And the but whys can go on in terms of why is his mom sick? Why did the place where his dad used to work close? Why does his dad not have much education? Addressing the social determinants requires digging into and addressing the messy and challenging underlying drivers of health. A current example of how the social realm can influence the public health realm is found in the Global Polio Eradication Initiative. This was launched in the 1980s with a partnership primarily, initially, by the Rotary International, the CDC, WHO, and UNICEF, and has a much broader range of partners now. Through surveillance, acute flaccid paralysis, and utilization of the oral polio vaccines at a cost of only 10 to 15 cents a dose, polio was eradicated from the Americas 20 years ago. One of three serotypes of wild-type polio virus was, and I should say eliminated from the Americas, and one of the serotypes of wild-type polio virus was globally eradicated in the year 2000. Two serotypes yet to go. And the total number of cases in the world fell from nearly a third of a million each year in the 1980s to only 223 cases in 2012, with transmission limited to only three countries, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Nigeria. To put that number into perspective, 60 years ago, within the lifespan of some of the people in this room, in Ketchikan, Alaska, 83 cases of flaccid acute polio infection occurred. But 2013 has not been a good year. After 10 years of being polio-free, vaccination rates in Somalia began to drift down again and had fallen to only about 30%. In this past May, a two-year-old girl in Somalia developed polio caused by a strain that was apparently imported from Nigeria. At least 173 other cases subsequently occurred in Somalia, with spillover of cases into neighboring Kenya and Ethiopia. To make matters worse, the Taliban has targeted women administering polio vaccines as Western agents and circulated rumors that the polio virus is designed to make children sterile. This is a major departure from some of the successes of recent years, where warlords have actually declared temporary ceasefires to allow vaccinations. To date, over 20 vaccinators have been assassinated. And also this year, over 4 million people have been displaced by the war in Syria. And within the past month, 13 cases of confirmed paralytic polio have been reported from refugee camps in western Syria. These are the first cases of polio in Syria since 1999. This is a great example of where even the best efforts of healthcare providers and public health professionals can be trumped by the social determinants. Improving global health and reducing disparities requires addressing health as a personal, public, and social issue. Personal responsibility is important. I'm not going to take anything away from that. But behavior changes need to be facilitated through the other realms, including access to good medical care. An example would be provision of nicotine patches for people who are addicted to tobacco. The public realm can provide information needed to change behavior and establish new norms of healthy behavior, whether that be how you drink water in the South Sudan or whether you drive a car after drinking alcohol in Anchorage. Addressing the social realm provides fertile ground for change to take root and healthy behavior to flourish in all our lives. And we can't forget that our individual behaviors influence the public realm, such as the risk from secondhand tobacco smoke to those who might be around us. as well as influencing the social realm. All four realms of influence are interrelated and important to improve global health in the future. In closing, I want to touch on three drivers of global health in the coming decades. First, it's expected that the global population will continue to increase from the current estimate of about 7 billion to about 10 million by 2050. But the 10 million in the world less than 40 years from now will look very different from the 7 million of today. Historically, the majority of humans have lived in rural areas. Today, for the first time, half of the world's population lives in urban areas. In the coming decades, the rural population is actually expected to shrink while the urban population continues to grow. By 2050, it's anticipated that two-thirds of the world's population will live in urban areas. 200 years ago, London was the first city in the world to have more than 1 million inhabitants. Today, there are over 456 cities with populations of over 1 million people. And the megacity, cities with a population of over 10 million, has entered our lexicon. Only 40 years ago, New York and Tokyo were the only megacities in the world. Today, there are 23, and it's estimated that in the next 12 years, there'll be 37 megacities. The majority will be in Asia. Urbanization is a two-edged sword when it comes to health. Cities are places where there are advantages. There's electricity, a greater likelihood of flush toilets, and running water. Cities have jobs, more opportunities for education, oftentimes health services are easier to access. There's types of entertainment that you will not find in rural areas. And in some areas of the world, an urban area provides more opportunity for participation in the political process. But there's also challenges. A lot of people crowded into a small area can create stresses on air and water quality. Crowding can facilitate transmission of infectious diseases. Land use can reduce the amount of arable land and have an impact on agriculture. Big cities, particularly in the temperate and tropical areas, are sometimes called heat islands, which really trap in heat from the daytime, creating microclimates that can be unhealthy. And with crowding, there can be challenges having enough safe and affordable housing, and there can be challenges with traffic and transportation, again, stressing air quality and increasing the risk of injury because of traffic accidents. In the 1960s, the end of the world as we know it was predicted because of overpopulation, and we were anticipated to have great famines and wars over food in the 1980s. I'm glad to say that didn't happen, but I think we need to be careful to not assume that the population bomb has been averted. It's at best been delayed. While the size of the global population is still a concern, the unanticipated decline in fertility has at least delayed that explosion, but brought us to another unprecedented 50-50 in the course of human history. Children have always outnumbered elders. Today, for the first time in the world, persons age 65 years and older equal the number of children age 5 and younger. And by the middle of this century, if current trends continue, we anticipate that there'll be two persons over age 65 for every child younger than 5. The aging of the population obviously creates opportunity for emergence of some of the chronic diseases that are related to age. And the level of age-related disability will likely increase with the graying of the world. Age-related dementia is already becoming an important cause of disability, and it's not restricted to high-income countries. In fact, by the middle of the century, it's estimated that two-thirds of the global population living with dementia will be living in low and middle-income countries. So it appears likely that there'll be more of us, we'll be more likely to live in cities, and we'll be older. However, we have to recognize that forecasting the future, I'm curious what the joke was, Tim, but Yeah, yes, we have to recognize that forecasting the future based on past trends can be a tricky business. There are a number of unknowns that could impact this. We don't know how these trends will be affected in the future by climate change or by the threat of global conflict or economic collapse or by the emergence of new infectious diseases. As the Nobel laureate physicist Niels Bohr once observed, predictions are hard to make, especially about the future. Now, that may sound less like something that would be said by a contemporary of Einstein than by Yogi Berra, but Yogi had his own wisdom on some of the predictions of the past. The future ain't what it used to be. So with that, I thank you for your attention. I'd be happy to take questions. I think we do have some time.
Thank you, Dr. Butler. I would ask that you wait to start your question until a microphone reaches you, and because we are recording this and we do want to get this on the air. So, if you'd raise your hands if you have a question.
Hello, I'm sorry. My name is Dr. Colleen Murphy. I had the joy and pleasure to work with the Indian Health Service for about 12 years and have been in the private sector since. And basically, I have some real concerns around healthcare financing and our more immediate reality of how our governor recently responded to the expansion of healthcare to the socioeconomically disadvantaged. And could you please comment on that? Because that's a real palpable reality.
Yes. Access to healthcare is one of those social realm issues that drive health. The exact outcome of Medicaid expansion or not expanding Medicaid is certainly one that I don't know that we have a definite answer, but there have been studies that have been done. Two that were published in the New England Journal of Medicine looked at either comparing among states or the experience in Oregon, where Medicaid was expanded. It was done on a lottery basis so they could compare people who were part of the expansion and those who weren't. In the first analysis, there were a number of health benefits afforded to the people who lived in the states where there was Medicaid expansion. Certainly, methodologically, we could raise questions about whether the comparisons were valid or not, but those were fairly compelling data and was all that was available until the Oregon data became available. The Oregon data has been used sometimes by people on both sides of the issue, because some of the health metrics, such as I recall, hypertension or control of diabetes, didn't seem to really stand out. But I would want to point out that one of the metrics that was a big difference was the measure of mental state of being. It's a 9-question questionnaire that we sometimes use, actually, in clinical practice at ANTHC. And it showed that the stress of being uninsured had a negative impact on mental health. So if we take the definition of health that includes mental well-being, there clearly would be a benefit from Medicaid expansion. And I think we also have to look at how that mental benefit could potentially, over a longer period of time, be associated with some better physical health outcomes either. The period of follow-up in the Medicaid expansion data from Oregon was fairly limited. And I think it comes down to what does it say about us as a society in terms of how we take care of the most poor and disaffected?
Yes, thank you for your comments. My name's Heather Hudson from ICER at UAA. I was struck from the time I got the announcement about your talk about the or in that slide, and I thought, no, it's clearly and I'm sure that's what he wants us to think. So for an example of an and, coming also raising a question about Alaska and what was the IHS and now Tribal Health Consortium, there are still villages, as you know, that don't have running water or sewage disposal systems, and others where those that do have them that aren't working very well. How do we, and this is not a developing country, how do we solve that problem and get the funders, or what do you see as the problem in recognizing that that really is an and needs to be available everywhere?
Yeah. Thank you for that question. First of all, it's recognizing the health impact of lack of running water. And I think some of the people in the room here have done some of those analyses that have shown that the lack of availability of running water is associated with higher risks of childhood hospitalizations due to respiratory tract infections and skin and soft tissue infections. We also look at that data and recognize that particularly skin and soft tissue infections and to some extent respiratory tract infections are not traditional waterborne diseases, but wash water diseases, that there's issues in terms of ability to be able to bathe and to wash that come into to play. The advances in rural sanitation over the past 25 years have been very gratifying. The caveat in that is, as we approach that final 20% of households, is the cost that's involved. We also have to look at some of the secondary effects. In many of our rural villages now, the number one source of consumption of energy is maintaining the water system and the sewage system. That creates a very large burden, economic burden on the village as well. So I think on one hand, we need to look at how do we get more resources to be able to improve sanitation, but we also need to think more innovatively in terms of, are there ways that we can provide wash water that are short of building an Anchorage-style municipal water system in some of our most remote villages?
So you... In particular, I was very struck by the slide on the graying of the population, not only increasing, but growing larger portions over the age of 65. It strikes me that that distribution is unlikely to be uniform, and I wonder if you could talk about some of the implications of that.
Yeah, that's a great question. I always love it when a question comes up that relates to a slide that I dropped to make sure that I don't go over. The distribution, one measure of the distribution of age as we look down the pike could be the median age. And certainly North America and Europe appear to be the countries that will be the oldest. That will be influenced somewhat by immigration rates and younger people coming from other parts of the world, particularly the youngest parts of the world, primarily Africa. But a number of countries in Europe have had natural increase, that is the death rate of the citizens factored in with the birth rate, that have been negative, that apart from immigration, they would actually have population declines. Some of the extreme examples, Spain, if it continues on its current course, will have a median age of about 55 by the middle of the century. Now, these trends are tricky, I realize. I mean, we could look at the Seward Highway and say, well, there was 2.3 people going down the Seward Highway in every car in 1975. That has declined to 1.5, and by 2050, there'll be one person in every third car. You know, it breaks down at some point, but it does show that the population is aging. You know, and it's really the two-edged sword of the aversion or the delay of the population bomb is that we've had the baby boom from the early 20th century that has aged without really a replacement of young people, particularly in the developed countries, while the developing countries have had more of a population boom. I think the good news is some of those poorer countries now, primarily because of empowerment of women, have a better handle on controlling fertility and bringing the birth rate down.
Hi. Here in Alaska, we have a big problem with alcohol. Now, how would you, I have a friend who works in an emergency unit. What, did I say something?
They have to go catch a bus.
I think they have a 1:30 class.
Anyway, I have a friend who works in an emergency unit, and she's convinced that that the effects of alcohol are understated, because she'll treat people who don't have a direct, like, they're not going through alcoholic seizures or anything like that. They're just like, I don't know, did something stupid while they're, you know, drunk. And, well, that's, well, my question is, I guess that's just a comment, but that alcohol is understated in health statistics, because she sees things that aren't cataloged as you know, to do with alcohol, but she knows that it is, you know, because her job is just to treat it. I guess my question is, you know, if you had an unlimited budget, I mean, what would you do about drugs and alcohol? I mean, because that goes to the, from a public policy perspective, what would you do about drug and alcohol abuse?
Okay, what a great question. And do you have that money by any chance? Okay, no. Well, let's start with alcohol, because I think that's a good example of where work in the social realm can begin to make a difference. You know, we have not been able to address the challenges of alcohol just working in healthcare alone, and even public health, which is generally focused on what you do when you're intoxicated to reduce the risk of drunk driving accidents, still hasn't addressed some of the bigger issues. I think at the social level, a good example of a program that may seem counterintuitive, but the data suggests it makes a difference, is Housing First. Providing housing, and this is addressing a very specific part of the problem, and that's the homeless chronic inebriate. But oftentimes people use alcohol to self-medicate. And one of those stressors that they may be self-medicating for is homelessness. So providing housing, actually, and Seattle has a number of years of experience with this now, has been shown to actually reduce alcohol consumption. And when I say housing first, that's what I mean. I mean, they're provided housing. They're still free to drink if they need to. But it's resulted, among the people who've been in Housing First programs, in reduced alcohol consumption and actually reduced healthcare system utilization. It seems very counterintuitive, but the data are quite compelling. The second part of your question, I would probably want to focus on the most abused drug of all, and the one that's at the population level the most addictive, and that would be tobacco. I mentioned that education is an important part of what occurs in the public realm. I think oftentimes funders kind of poo-poo that, because oftentimes public health education is some brochures that are by a rack by the door. But I really think we need to actually follow the example of the public sector and look at marketing. If you fly into any major city in the world, you will see pictures of what? A cowboy. What's he selling? Cigarettes. What brand of cigarette? Marlboro. Everybody knows that. And it doesn't even have, he's smoking a cigarette, but it doesn't even have the logo on there. We all know that. Marketing really works. And of course, it's really ironic that this iconic figure of independence is selling a product that makes you dependent on supplemental oxygen. It makes no sense at all. I think the CDC here in the United States has really gone in the right direction with their tips from former smokers. And maybe you've seen the commercials. I think the one that's most striking is Terry, the woman who starts her morning describing how she gets ready for the day. And she's putting in her false teeth. She's putting on her wig. She's putting a scarf that covers her tracheostomy. Terry's story is very personal and very real, and at least the marketing studies I've seen, it's really had an impact. Terry was only 40 years old when she developed oral cancer, and actually continued to smoke while she was getting radiation because she thought the radiation would cure the cancer. Subsequently, she developed laryngeal cancer and had to have a laryngectomy, and that got her attention because she couldn't sing to her grandchildren anymore. And unfortunately, she developed yet another tobacco-related cancer. And so as she was suffering under treatment of cancer, she actually was in touch with the CDC and did these ads. Terry died 2 months ago at age 53 from tobacco. But I think she has quite a legacy in terms of the impact she can have in, if you will, marketing health and telling her story.
Thank you, Dr. Butler. I wish we had more time, because I think there's some more questions here. Perhaps you could stick around afterwards. I see Bill Pops here, and he's got his hockey skates off. And he was our partner. Bill is the CEO of the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation. He's our partner in this presentation. And I wanted to give you a chance to have the remarks, say the remarks that you were going to do when you were going to introduce Dr. Butler.
I think before I say any remarks, I'd like to give a round of applause for Dr. Butler. It was a phenomenal presentation. Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, several years ago in 2009, launched a vision for Anchorage that we would be the number one city in America to live, work, and play by 2025. And health is an important issue in terms of the community redevelopment effort that we are focusing on. It isn't a marketing deal. It's about changing Anchorage so that business can flourish. And when we look at statistics like the fact that if you take our other three cities in this national survey that we participate in, and these other three Alaska cities, if you take out Kodiak, Fairbanks, and Juneau out of the survey, Anchorage is the most expensive city in the United States for healthcare. The most expensive. We have other issues like housing that was brought up. We are the 20th most expensive housing market in the United States. And that's leaving Fairbanks, Juneau, and Kodiak in the picture. So we've got some headwinds to deal with, and we feel that education is going to be a key issue in that, and the Alaska World Affairs Council offers a great venue, and we were very pleased and honored to be able to help support this particular presentation. I've got one ask of the folks in the room who are parts, are leaders in business or in other organizations, and that is to take our Business Confidence Index survey. We are on the street with that survey right now. We're getting a phenomenal response, but we need more. It's a survey of where you think the economy is going to go in the next year. What are the issues that are opportunities for us? What are the issues that are headwinds for us? Is it housing? Is it workforce development? Is it training? What are the issues? Please take the survey. Go to our website, aedcweb.com, or you can just Google us at Anchorage Economic Development Corporation. Go to the website, take the survey. And with that, I will end my comments here because I'm the only person between you and the door. So thank you so much.
Now, before everybody stands up, I would like to remind you that our next presentation is on December 5th at 7 p.m. at the KAKM Studios. It's a film followed by a panel discussion called Girl Rising. Hope to see you there. If you enjoyed today's program, please go to our website. You'll see additional programming that we have planned. And if you really liked it, please consider being a member. This is member-supported programming. We can't do this without your time and your donations, and we'd certainly like to have you become members in our organization. With that, I've got one last thing, and that's a gift for Dr. Butler.
Is this it? I hope so.
Good. Thank you. Anyway, thank you very much, Dr. Butler, for joining us. And if you do have any additional questions, please feel free to come up. I'll volunteer some of Dr. Butler's time to answer some more questions. Thank you.
Very good. Bill, thank you.